This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Happy Thanksgiving. On this holiday, we revisit two interviews from this fall. Coming up, Bridge, Michigan senior writer Ron French tells us what education reform in other states can tell us about the efforts to improve learning in Michigan. But first, Housing Resources Incorporated in Kalamazoo launched a campaign to find safe, permanent housing for 80 families this holiday season. HRI's Executive Director Michelle Davis joined us in October to discuss the Home for the Holidays campaign. Michelle Davis, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Give us the basic idea of the Home for the Holidays project.
Home for the Holidays was really born out of an idea last year where Kalamazoo, in all of its generosity, typically around the holidays, we receive lots of calls with people wanting to donate food and clothing and toys for the families that we serve, including those that are in our Eleanor House family shelter. And it was about the second week of December, and far too late, that my brain kicked in. And I went, you know, what if all of these kids were receiving these toys and the families that we were serving had these wonderful gifts in a home instead of in our shelter or any shelter in the Kalamazoo area? So at that point, I started to brainstorm a little bit about what it could look like this year. And that's really where the idea was born, that let's try to get our families out of homelessness and into housing in time for the holidays so that no child is really waking up in a shelter, if at all possible.
How did you settle on the number of 80 families to help?
We really looked at the numbers that we had served last year, what was a little bit of a stretch, but realistic, given a financial goal of $50,000, what an average rental subsidy or housing assistance amount might be for that family, and really settled at that amount of $50,000 at an average of $625 per household, sometimes leveraging other funds, sometimes not, to get a family in. And that's how we arrived at the 80 families.
So let's deal a little bit with logistics. Are there 80 places available out there where a family could have safe housing, which could include, of course, young children where you would have concerns about, the environment, things they'd be breathing, that sort of thing?
So that's always the challenge. It takes a lot of different avenues coming together to create that home for that family. So along with that financial assistance, we provide supportive services that once people are in housing, what are the things that we can help them with and wrap around them that keep them housed? But finding that housing can be tricky. There is a shortage of affordable housing units in our area. National statistics will tell you that that figure is somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 units short of affordable housing. So we rely heavily on our local landlords, and we have about 75 active landlords, 150 total on our list, who work with us so that when units become available, they help with the families we have and accept them into those units. So that's a constant struggle that would also be part of this initiative, to help engage landlords who may have units at this time and take these families, especially for the holidays.
I mean, would the landlords be doing that, gratis? Are they getting something for the rent that they would normally collect on a place if it were otherwise occupied?
So a landlord would go through a process with us that's fairly simple. There are some things they have. The unit would have to be city certified if it's in the city of Kalamazoo. Other townships and cities outside of the city of Kalamazoo don't necessarily have a certification, a rental certification. We do what's called a housing quality standards inspection, an HQS. We do that on every unit that we provide housing assistance for to that landlord to make sure that that's a safe place as well as an affordable place for someone to live. So a landlord's unit would have to pass that inspection. They would have to agree to work with us for a subsidy or the security deposit or the first month's rent that that family might receive. And that's a list of minor requirements that those landlords would have to meet, and they just have to be willing to do that. We do not have necessarily a rental requirement. They can set the rent. What we do have, if we're using other funds, some of the government funds we have, there are some limits to what our subsidies might have to be.
Are there criteria that are going to be set for families that ultimately receive this help?
What's tricky is that we have a large funnel of people that come to us. And this year, the amount of contacts that we've received for assistance in the first 8 months has doubled. So we have gone from around 5,000 in the first 8 months of 2013 to 10,000 so far in 2014. That large funnel has to filter into very finite, rather restricted funding sources. That's why this $50,000 becomes important for us to be able to stretch and leverage those dollars and provide those supports to those families so that that affordable housing remains permanent and sustainable. So those numbers are large, but we serve hundreds of families every year.
Once you get these families into housing, assuming that this is as successful as everyone hopes it is, and 80 families do have a safe place, stable place to stay for the holidays, what then do you do to ensure that they can stay there beyond that into January, February, et cetera, of 2015?
We have varying levels of service delivery options that we have. It does depend on what the family, what their core needs are. What are the reasons that they became homeless in the first place? What's it going to take for them to have sustainability? So one of the things in our work that's super important to us is that this is not just about housing. This is about income improvement, employment improvement. It's about education. It's about the fact that that child, it has a stable place to live that then enables that child to be able to have increased attendance in school that leads to on-time grade completion and ultimately on-time graduation. So there are supportive services that wrap around that family in all of those areas that are part of our federal goals, actually, through our HUD grants. We have to show that people are achieving those things.
So if you were to place 80 families through this program, they have a place to stay for the holidays and beyond, how big a dent, realistically, would that be putting in the problem of homelessness throughout Kalamazoo?
The reality is that the resources are far too few for the amount of need. So every day we serve so many people. Every year we serve hundreds. Every year we are in contact with thousands of people in need, but the resources don't match the need. And it's important to remember that that does not mean that all of the agencies in town aren't being successful. We are achieving success with housing every day in this community, but the need is great and the resources continue to be cut or unfunded. There are unfunded mandates that we face. So it puts a dent for the holidays, but the day after the holidays are over, come January, we've got another 80 in need. So it's an ongoing issue.
People have been hearing lots of stories on this radio station, or perhaps reading the Kalamazoo Gazette or New York Times, that the economy's getting better, the unemployment rate's coming down. But as someone who's dealing with the issue of people trying to find stable, affordable housing, is that problem getting better as the economy shows some signs of improvement?
We don't necessarily see it getting better. We see incremental improvements in people's wages. We see when there are jobs being created in the community that those we serve are able to access that. But more importantly, what we've seen is that that face of a homeless family has changed. So before, if you considered the homeless gentleman on the street in a cardboard box, which many people think of as that's the face of homelessness, that's no longer the case. I would guarantee that you're not really seeing the homeless the way that we see them. So every Wednesday we have a housing hour from 4 to 5 o'clock where people can come to our building, no appointment necessary, and talk about their housing emergency or housing crisis. It's there that you see the person whose household is making $10 an hour. $10 an hour is not a housing wage. It will not afford housing for a family of four. You're somewhere over $14 an hour for a family of four working full time to have a two-bedroom apartment. So we constantly work on that income improvement. Those people who have zero income, obtaining that $10 an hour job is far better than they were. But let's not make any mistake that those people are still coming to us for assistance.
So when you say you're seeing people that don't fit maybe the preconceived notion we have of what a homeless person looks like, are you also seeing then children, you know, part of families coming in who are also left without a home for now?
Absolutely. In fact, last year over the holidays, there were 18 kids that woke up Christmas morning in our family shelter at Eleanor House. And that's just a portion of kids that were in shelter in Kalamazoo County.
What needs to be done more broadly to address the issue of homelessness beyond the holidays when people may be a little more generous with an organization like yours? What would be the public policy changes that you would recommend that would get at the issue of housing and homelessness?
Policy and systemic changes are key for this. Data-driven policy and system changes are what's most important. I think there's often a lot of anecdotal stories that go along with homelessness, but having really hard data about the successes and the needs is crucial. So what is our housing inventory? We know there's a lack of affordable housing. What does that really mean? What are the policies and systems issues in our area that can make it more beneficial for someone to create affordable housing units? How could landlords be incentivized perhaps to work with us and offer up maybe one of the units out of the 15 they might have for someone who has zero income? And how do we make that attractive to landlords who maybe want to give back, but that's not maybe economically feasible for them? This is their revenue. So it's those kinds of systems and policy issues that I think we could take a look at.
How hard is it to get at accurate data on the issue of homelessness, available housing, and also what it would take to get people from homelessness into stable housing?
There's a lot of data available. There is many sources, but it's difficult to coordinate it all right now. So for example, through HUD, we have what's called HMIS, the Homeless Management Information System. That gives us a really good idea in Kalamazoo County. Every community in the nation is required to have what's called a continuum of care. And in that continuum of care, everyone has an HMIS system. So we know from that system who we're serving, who are the homeless, who's chronically homeless, which is a whole different definition. And we know the various levels of services people are receiving. That's a whole set of data that's very different than housing inventory, what rents are, what's considered affordable housing, home ownership. So the goal is really the whole spectrum. What's the data on the whole spectrum of a community that has a framework for affordable housing? And what are the successes that Kalamazoo is experiencing to plug into that? And we have a lot of success here, not just with HRI, but a lot of good organizations doing good work. So it's pulling all that together that gets complicated.
Michelle Davis, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Davis is Executive Director of Housing Resources Incorporated in Kalamazoo. You can find more information about Project Home for the Holidays through links at our website, wmuk.org. Since our interview in October, Housing Resources Incorporated announced that the organization has surpassed its fundraising goal and has found housing for 35 families so far. Housing Resources Incorporated says it's on track for its goal of finding housing for 80 families. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In September, Bridge, the online news service of the Center for Michigan, examined what some other states have done to improve education. In their series called The Smartest Kids, Bridge reported on education reform efforts in other states. Bridge senior writer Ron French joined us in September. Ron French, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What states did you choose and why those?
We ended up visiting Minnesota, Tennessee, Florida, and Massachusetts. It was interesting. We looked at a lot of states and a lot of data, and we wanted to look at states that either had high student achievement or fast-growing student achievement. And we're measuring those by the one standardized test that is taken by all 50 states called the National Assessment of Educational Performance. And Massachusetts and Minnesota are very high-achieving, have been for a number of years, and are continuing to increase their scores. Tennessee and Florida, interestingly enough, a decade ago, both had scores significantly lower than Michigan's test scores. Since then, their scores have surpassed Michigan, and Tennessee is the fastest growing state in the nation in these test scores. So something's going on in all of these states, and what we wanted to do is try to look at these states, visit them, and get a sense of whether there are some state policies in place there that are impacting these scores that we might be able to steal and use in Michigan.
Well, let's begin with Minnesota, which is a fellow Great Lakes state. And many progressives here in Michigan have been saying that this is a state that Michigan should look to as a role model. So what is Minnesota doing in broad terms to make their test scores go up? As you say, they're already higher than Michigan's, and they're improving faster than we are.
Sure. Interestingly enough, you would think with Minnesota's reputation as a high-tax state, and it is a high-tax state, you'd think that, well, the answer must be money. But actually, they spend almost identically the same amount of money that Michigan spends per pupil. Their teacher salaries are slightly lower than Michigan's, so it's not money. Minnesota was the birthplace of charter schools, but they have fewer charter schools than Michigan, so it's not charter schools. So what is going on there? There are a couple of things that are unique about Minnesota that I think Michigan can learn some lessons from. First and foremost, they have an early childhood program, which no other state has, where it's universal. Anyone can go to it, no matter how much money you make, no matter what your background, that is for ages birth to kindergarten. And in that program, it's not just someplace where you drop off your kids. The parents come too, and there is supervised playtime with the parent and the child together. And what happens is these certified teachers who specialize in early learning work with the parents to teach them how to play in a way that helps the children learn. And so really what happens in Minnesota is there's a concerted effort to make parents be the child's first teacher. And it's something that's been going on for 40 years, and we think it has a major impact.
Does Michigan have anything which compares to this? We do know that there has been an effort, pretty bipartisan and across the board in Michigan, to increase funding for early childhood education. Is there anything in Michigan which compares to what they're doing in Minnesota?
Michigan has the Great Start Readiness Program, which is a great program for four-year-olds. It's a program that is specifically for low and moderate income families. It's a great service, and it's very good that Michigan has expanded. What Minnesota also has a version of that. What Michigan does not have is anything of significance that tries to work with children and parents of 0 to 3. And that's something that perhaps we're going to need to try to look at.
So Minnesota and Michigan are spending roughly the same amount per pupil on education. Is Minnesota, though, distributing the money differently? Are they spending it in ways which are different from what we're doing in Michigan?
What Minnesota does is that they funnel more money in a very concerted effort to schools with higher concentrations of poverty. In Michigan, you have a per pupil allotment, which is generally the same across schools. In Minnesota, there is a base of that, but then a school with a high level of poverty could get as much as between $2,000 and $3,000 more per pupil than a wealthier suburban district. And what that does is those schools where there is the greatest need. Because, you know, students from low-income families generally struggle more than students from suburban families. So what that does is it allows those low-income schools to hire more staff. One example of a school I visited in Minnesota, they had 26 classrooms, pretty standard type of elementary school, but they had, among that, they also had six teachers that were just floating, that worked with small groups of students. They had two English as a second language teachers full-time, and they had a full-time social worker. And those are seem like luxuries here, but in Minnesota, it's normal.
You also note that if we look at the economic indicators, Minnesota seems to be better off, a much lower unemployment rate, per capita income higher in Minnesota than it is in Michigan. Do the people in Michigan and, you know, any sort of what we could call objective experts who've looked at it believe that those things are linked? In other words, that because Minnesota has made these improvements in their education system, it has led to better economic conditions?
I think most experts say that. If you, another example of a state we're going to be writing about is Massachusetts, which had a terrible economy 30, 40 years ago. It has a great economy now. What did they do? They focused their efforts on education. Minnesota did the same thing, and you see the outcome. Minnesota has one of the highest rates of college attainment in the nation. I know that some critics may say, well, as your income goes up, student test scores generally go up. And so is it really fair to compare Minnesota and Michigan at this point? That's a fair criticism until you then look at the scores of low-income students, because they're counted the same, because they're all a free and reduced lunch eligible student in Minnesota is the same as a free and reduced lunch eligible student in Michigan. Their low-income students do much better than our low-income students. So something's going on there, and it's helping their kids. And because they have higher graduation rates, higher college attainment rates, that helps the economy.
Tennessee, on the other hand, is a state which lags behind Michigan on many of those economic indicators. And as you report, the test scores in Tennessee are still below the national average, or below the median anyway, of states across the nation. But those scores are going in the right direction, on their way up. What has Tennessee done?
They've taken a different approach. And this goes to show that there isn't just one answer to this sort of thing, Gordon. What Tennessee has done is a couple of things. One, Tennessee has been very aggressive on high-stakes evaluations, both for teachers and for students. Tennessee retains its third graders in third grade if they're not reading at a certain level. They retain eighth graders if they're not scoring at a proficiency level. They also have a program where teachers can lose their jobs if over a period of several years their students are not growing in achievement as much as they should be. But going along with that, they didn't just put this hammer out there saying, we're going to get rid of bad teachers. What they did is, in Tennessee, they spent a lot of money on teacher training. That really needs to go hand in hand with a tough evaluation system. That if you're going to say we're going to hold you accountable, you also need to be able to say, here's how we're going to help teachers learn the new standards. Here's how we're going to help them become better teachers. Because, you know, in the end, Gordon, we're all trying to help the students learn more. And so how do you do that? It's not just by threatening teachers. It's by helping teachers become better teachers.
And your reporting actually shows that very few teachers have been fired as a result of these standards, correct?
Yes, and I think that should be expected here in Michigan also. That's what gets the headlines. And frankly, perhaps that gives some incentive for schools to buckle down. I don't know, but I do know that what has really changed the culture in the schools in Tennessee hasn't been the threat of losing jobs. It's been the incredible increase in conversation that teachers and are having among themselves and between teachers and principals, because part of the evaluation process is a lot more of classroom observation. So, you know, it's the coaching that, you know, that's what's important that has happened in Tennessee.
You do have something coming up on Florida. Can you give us a little idea of what Florida has done in terms of education?
Florida's done a couple of things. One, they were the earliest adopter of something that is very common now, which is linking student test scores to teacher evaluations. And there were pluses and minuses to that. It's still controversial. But the other thing that Florida is really known for and makes a big difference there, you know, Florida used to be ranked in a lot of these sort of rankings, education rankings, 49th. They're still in the middle of the pack, but they've really gone up and they've passed Michigan. What Florida did is they put a huge, massive emphasis on early grade reading skills. They invested a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of training into helping kids learn to read by the end of their third grade. And they, too, have a third grade retention program. But the point is that they retain very few because they put this huge emphasis on training. And so that is something that we need to look at, too, is if we think that it's important to read by the end of third grade, then the emphasis isn't about like saying, by gosh, we're going to hold these kids back until they learn. The emphasis really needs to be on how are we going to help these kids. You know, it's extra staff, extra programs, and extra training for the teachers.
So, Ron, you've taken a look at some other states, and of course, you know, the reaction back here in Michigan is to wonder what we should take here. And I guess one thing we wonder is, are there some differences in how states govern, perhaps some cultural differences in other states that might make things that work very well in Tennessee or Florida or Minnesota not work so well in Michigan? Did you find anything in your reporting that indicated that, or do you think that these things are very evidence-based, and if we wanted to bring them to Michigan, we could, it's a matter of political will and perhaps so being willing to spend the money?
Different things are working in different states, but I think you hit on the key there. It's a matter of political will and building a consensus around a reform effort and sticking to it. When I've gone to state leaders in other states and asked for their say, what advice would you give to a legislator in Michigan? They say, come up with a reform, you know, get people behind it and stick with it. This is something that will take 15, 20 years. It'll go through 2, 3, 4 governors before you really see a massive amount of results. But you have to be willing to stick with it past a few years. So the keys are not that one thing works in each state. It's that all these states, no matter what approach they took, they chose a reform, they've stuck with it, and they've been patient.
Ron French, thank you for your time. Ron French is senior writer for Bridge, the online news service of the Center for Michigan. Our interview with Bridge senior writer Ron French originally aired in September. We hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we'll be back with a new program on Monday. For WMUK's West Southwest, I'm Gordon Evans.